ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
There is wonder in the ordinary, in the objects we touch, the tools we use, the things we forget to notice, each one shaped by human hands, human need, and human imagination, each one carrying a quiet story of ingenuity. This is Extraordinary Everyday. I'm Anthony Burke. Safety in our workplaces has improved over the last century, and one of the most ubiquitous symbols of this is the high-vis vest. We see them everywhere, on roadside work sites and building sites across towns and cities. But this article of clothing is a very recent invention. Dr. Elizabeth Humphreys is an associate professor in social and political science at UTS, and she's been researching the history of the high-vis vest. Elizabeth, welcome.
Thanks for having me on the show.
Well, let's go back to the beginning, like life before high-vis. Like, why were they invented? What was life like in a safety sense before we needed high-vis vests?
This is an important question, I think, because when we track the sort of adoption of high-vis vests in certain industries, and particularly when we do it through photo databases, like the New South Wales Transport has a massive archive, we can see what people wore before. So in that industry, it was largely men wearing boiler suits, darker colours, in summer, stubbies, no shirt, or like a tank top, you know. And that also tells us something important, that workers need different sorts of clothing for different weather in Australia. And the high-vis vest had to, the people who were sort of developing it overseas and in Australia had to think about a whole range of things, the weather, comfort, as well as visibility, which was the primary driver in its adoption.
So to go from those dark-coloured dungarees or some version of that into something conspicuous.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. And but I guess before that, I did ask, my dad worked in an oil refinery my whole life, and I asked him what they wore before high-vis vests there, and really it was white.
Right.
But of course, white also dulls after being washed, and maybe I'm getting ahead of myself, but keeping the fastness of high-vis colour in garments was a huge battle in the early creation of high-vis clothing and high-vis vests.
So when were the earliest versions of the high-vis vest introduced?
The earliest versions that have sort of been well documented are on the rails in the United Kingdom, particularly in places like Glasgow, where men were getting up early to work, often in a lot of clothing with heavy jackets, and these kind of short cropped waistcoats, I guess, for want of a better word, in orange, were introduced voluntarily to try and avoid deaths and near misses when these workers were working on rail. But even in the, and this is in the 50s and 60s, it's really in the early 60s in Australia that state government departments start trying to work out how are they going to keep workers safe in very particular industries, roads and rail. So it's always about workers who are working around moving machinery, be that cars on a road or later huge earth-moving equipment on mining sites. But they sent people overseas to the UK, but also to the Texas Road Department to track their efforts to try and develop clothing that could be worn while working and would keep workers safe.
And their look, I mean, how different were they to the kind of high-vis vest I'm imagining from today?
In some ways, not that different. One thing they're trying to work out is the visibility. But the other thing is, like, high-vis vests don't exist separately from the bodies of these workers. We're largely talking about male workers in this period. So vests need to, say in the case of Australia post-orange vests, they need to be able to be worn while walking, while on motorbikes. They also need to be visible while people bend over, for example. So they're thinking a lot about how a body moves and how that body can always be seen. At the same time, they're trying to think about breathability in a period where synthetic fabrics like nylon don't exist.
Yeah.
So how are you going to create a high-vis vest that stays colour fast, that can be washed, that fits on a moving body and different types of body shapes? And so the vest is kind of a natural way to do that. A torso can carry a large amount of material that sort of stays flat in some ways. But then there's a real struggle. Like in the 60s, the first materials are like petrochemical materials. And if you want it waterproof, it's PVC. This does not bode well for staying cool when you're doing hard labor, digging up roads and you know, shifting heavy machinery around. So there's a sort of a long evolution from those early days.
When did the color come into the picture? I mean, sounds a bit silly, but like first high-vid vests, when, I mean, thinking fluorescent yellow, for example, like really specific colors that we probably hadn't seen much before.
Yeah, in the end, there's international standards developed about these colours, but we did look at some records. I think it was either South Australian or Tasmanian Rail, where they did try different colours, but they tried pink in particular, which has what may have encountered some issues in terms of masculinity and the workplace, but that was not so much what was documented. It was that it really didn't attract attention. Even though pink is one of the international standard high-vis colours, and the orange was seen as the most visible. And so, yeah, I think like, it, you know, I was coming to the studio to talk to you today and yellow was the main colour I was seeing. And so perhaps that's a later sort of adoption of that colour, particularly for delivery cyclists, which is where I, you know, was seeing high-vis on my trip in here today. But in those days, orange was the preferred colour.
Yeah, I suppose there's the issue of selecting the colour itself, but then also the sort of the technical side of how do you make the colour. Yeah. What's that story?
So the origins of fluorescence, making fluorescence, is usually sort of pinpointed to the Schweitzer brothers and Dayglow colour, which is a long time. It's in the earlier 1900s. And so really fluorescence sort of starts being used earlier in the 1900s, quite a bit in World War II, but it doesn't really come into the workplace until late 50s, early 60s, into the 70s. So there's two high-vis vests at the Powerhouse in New South Wales, and people can, if you want to search Australia Post high-vis vest in their online catalogue, you'll be able to look at these two vests, and that's 75. Mm. So it's still early in the adoption, but probably 10 years after they start really trying to think about roads and then a little bit later railway in Australia. Yeah.
So we know that workers in Australia started wearing them, let's say in the 1960s, more or less. Was that any particular industry that took it on first? Was it the railroads?
Really just in initially in roadworks.
Oh, in roadworks,
And then later rail. Mm. It really doesn't proliferate far from there until much later. I think a few things sort of happen to cause the proliferation that we see today. And it sort of happens in a couple of stages. In 1972, there was a thing called the Robins Review about work health and safety, occupational health and safety in the UK. And this really set a new path for how work health and safety was going to happen. And it was very influential in Australia as well. Whilst we didn't get national uniform rules, and I think until 2011 in Australia, the states were really following that UK lead. So you get this push for safer workplaces that's come about through union pressure and state government initiative in particular. The other thing you get is changes to fabrics, right? So synthetic fabrics and lightweight fabrics are huge in being able to stay colour fast, so stay fluorescent through multiple washes. So we get from this PVC and these petrochemical plastics, we first actually go to fiberglass mesh, right? Now that sounds slightly odd, but actually it's quite lightweight and it can be made breathable. And so there was this sort of improvement that helped encourage people to adopt it, because the last thing you want is people giving people these vests and then they have to take them off because they're too hot. Mm. But it's not really until we get these synthetic fabrics that we get global supply chains, we get the shift of manufacturing to the global south, based out, and this is some of the contradictions, based out of cheap exploitative labour, that we can get cheap high-vis made in massive quantities delivered to countries in the global north like Australia. So now today we have this odd thing where safety of workers is dependent on the very cheap and underpaid labour and the environmental catastrophe of fast fashion imported from the global south into the global north.
So it's kind of a nasty circle.
Yes, and so it's not just a linear story of we get better and better at safety and this is social progress. Embedded in the social progress of high vis is this story of environmental degradation through overproduction and the safety of workers in this country being dependent on the exploitative labour and low wages, I guess, of the global south. So it's a complicated story.
Yeah, it is, yeah. And that explosion then of the high vis coming into, I guess, society at large, you were saying that's in Australia that was around 2000?
Yeah, so that's where we've dated it to. It's hard to sort of, you know, pick this point, partly because it's all manufactured by private companies. It's not like easy to access the sort of data. And even they calculate uniforms in particular ways. We might not ever be able to extract when does high-vis explode. But we track it partly by looking at these photos. When does it start to explode in the database of road construction in New South Wales? But also when we've got this big cultural database, we call it our vignettes database, where every time we see high-vis mentioned in any sort of context, we've been shoving examples in this big database to see when it sort of enters the cultural imagination. This has shown that really the year 2000, it's when also politicians start to wear high-vis. So we first see Tony Blair wear it just prior to the millennium. And then, you know, we see Laurie Brereton, I think maybe he's the earliest used on staged photos from New South Wales Transport. Now, of course, we see it at every election, almost in every flyer. It becomes this cultural signal about class and the working man mobilised by politicians to appeal to a certain voter base. So for us, yes, there's this. It's almost shifted as this purely almost safety item now to be worn not just for safety, but in these cultural contexts and by workers who may not need it for safety. Does the security guard outside the chemist on Marrickville Road need to be in high vis at the front door at 9 p.m. at night? No, there's no safety reason. It's almost just a uniform.
So for the high vis vest or high vis clothing, where to from here?
We really have to tackle, I think, the environmental consequences. Fast fashion, it has to be dealt with. So we want high quality high vis, right? We don't want it to fade. We want it to meet international standards. We don't necessarily want it made at the cheapest price point because we know those workers might be in Bangladeshi factories, right, who are working in appalling conditions with appalling OHS. So there are some battles, I think, to be had socially over the production of high-vis. But we also want to make sure that high-vis is used, I think, where it's needed.
Elizabeth, thank you so much for that information. There's so much in the high-vis vest that I really wasn't aware of, and it's got so much carriage into the future. Thanks very much.
Thanks for having me on today.
That's Dr. Elizabeth Humphreys, Associate Professor in Social and Political Science at UTS. To find more episodes, visit ABC Listen and follow the show. Search Anthony Burke's By Design. Who knew that the high-vis vest had so many different cultural meanings, or how hard it was to find a way to make fluorescent colour stick? Perhaps you work in an industry with a nifty tool that you'd like to know the design history of. Let us know. Email us at bydesign@abc.net.au.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.